Tonight, we're really racing, as I always feel I am in Isaiah here, but we're looking at, in the last couple of weeks, these groupings of prophecies in Isaiah chapter 7 through 12. So chapter 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 fall under a kind of a very broad and general title as you read commentaries and whatnot. These are thought of as the Emmanuel prophecies. That because the word Emmanuel, sometimes used as a word, that would be a person's name in Isaiah, as well as the New Testament, or just simply translated God with us, as it appears both ways in these prophecies. So we've been looking at it, as I say, a couple of weeks. The actual word is found in 7:14, 8:8, and 8:10, but as a general rule, we look at those chapters 7 through 12, the Emmanuel prophecies. They then can be broken down at sort of the first level to three different sections, which we started in last week. The Emmanuel prophecies of chapter 7 through 12 are actually chapter 7 verse 1 through chapter 9 verse 7. That's pretty clearly one prophecy in the group. Then you have a second prophecy we'll be looking at tonight from chapter 9 verse 8 through chapter 10 verse 4. And then you have a third group of prophecies, which I'd love to see, you know, let's finish this evening with Nigh Unto Impossible, I suppose, which would be 10:5 through 12:6. Even these can be broken down again. So, in the first of the three Emmanuel prophecies, 7:1 through 9:7, it really has three clear sections, too. So we're just, you know, as Bible students, trying to find ways to identify the material, handle the material, teach the material, understand, you know, how God reveals himself. And so in this case, you know, if you want to say, well, there's really three separate prophecies in 7:1 to 9:7. Well, I can understand. That's fine. Nobody's going to argue with it. It's not like there's some big text coming or that. You know, God is going to be unhappy. You know, how we choose to try and group the material so that we can understand it better. But we did look at three unique kinds of sections within the first of the three Emmanuel prophecies, which was 7:1 through 9:7. 9:8 through 10:4, that second group, it comes in only one section, though. It's a nice, concise, tight little prophecy. We'll look at that in just a few minutes. And then 10:5 through 12:6, as you can see, is a lot of verses. And it breaks down, though, into, again, two pretty clear sections. And yet the subject matter is so related that we don't think of it as two separate prophecies. It appears to be Isaiah's one revelation that's dealing, if you will, with two related aspects, which we'll talk about, again, a little bit later in the class. Now, I completed the first one last week, so we're, you know, you'd think, we say, well, okay, we got through that, we'll leave that alone. But Haverstock can never leave anything well enough alone, and we still wanted to show you one more thing. At the close of the class, I gave you some verse references, but we didn't go over and look at them, because in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 14, it says, "Do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled." But clearly, Peter is referencing Isaiah 8, verse 12. So please stay in Isaiah. I'm going to put the quotations from the New Testament passages up there. But in Isaiah chapter 8, and verse 12, it says, "You're not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it." Now, I want to go through this for a couple of reasons. One, just to see how often Isaiah appears in the New Testament. But also, in this little set of just 13 verses, four times Isaiah is going to be quoted in the New Testament from just these 13 verses. It's four different books. And so this prophecy in just verses 8, 12 through 9, 2, 13 verses, 1 Peter says, "Do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled." Isaiah says, "You're not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it." Obviously, Peter is thinking about Isaiah 12. But what I wanted to show you is not just how much of Isaiah is going to show up in the New Testament. I also want you to see that references and allusions and quotations are three different ways that the New Testament will utilize Old Testament passages. So I'll show you this one. We'll look at the next ones very rapidly. But just note as we go through these four, they're not every one a word-for-word quote. They don't all start off with, I'm the New Testament now referencing Isaiah 8 verse 12. You know, they're not that specific. You don't necessarily have this fulfills that in your New Testament quotation. So what I want us to see is that the New Testament spends a tremendous amount of time referencing and utilizing the Old Testament. But it does it across a broad spectrum. From sometimes like this one, which we would think must be an awful loose translation and a pretty oblique reference, to some that are extremely specific. That's okay. God does that a lot. And we do too when we're working with New Testament scriptures as well. We always have the truth. We don't necessarily need a direct quote. So 1 Peter says, do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled. But Isaiah said, you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. Then, just two verses later, in Isaiah 8:14 is quoted in Romans 9:33 with the appellation, just as it is written. So now we're getting a more specific reference. Just as it is written, it says in Romans 9:33, behold, I lay in Zion a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed. Now please note, Romans says, just as it is written, and then it uses those words. The only place it can be referring to where it would be written in the Old Testament is Isaiah 8:14. He shall become a sanctuary, but to both the houses of Israel, a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over. Now, do you see what I mean? These two passages are more directly related, aren't they, than the one we looked at on the previous slide? But still, Romans 9:3 adds Zion, which doesn't appear in Isaiah. And so while you can see a lot of words, and they must be talking about the same thing, they're not identical. And still, it's just as it is written. So don't expect every time that your New Testament is going to go back and get an absolutely direct quote. As a matter of fact, sometimes your New Testament is going to say, for instance, just as, you know, Moses said. And it saved your life. You won't be able to find a passage that looks anything like the one in the New Testament. You'll say, well, where did Moses say that? Moses never did say that directly in so many words. Now, it's the most, we might say, obscure, but, you know, that's a kind of a misleading word. Now, though, there's a thought, an idea, a concept, a principle that Moses had presented. And it's being referenced in the New Testament. And it's as Moses said. But you couldn't find any single verse that ever says anything like that. These are concepts and ideas. So I just wanted you to see the full spread there. And now we have Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 13. The third of these three says, behold, I and the children whom God has given me. Isaiah 8:18 says, behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me. Well, now we're really close to identical, aren't we? There's only one word change. God over here, the Lord over there. But then Isaiah says, our four signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. And in the Hebrew letter, it's being used somewhat differently, and all of that is being left off. He's pulling a certain section out that applies to the point that the Hebrew writer is trying to make. And then lastly, we have our very direct quotation. In Matthew 4:15-16, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, beyond Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who were sitting in darkness saw a great light, and those who were sitting in the land in shadow of death, upon them a light dawned. Thus saith Matthew 4:15-16. Isaiah, you get to the next chapter now, chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, says, in earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee, and the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land the light will shine on them. Now see how very close those two are. See that now Matthew is using it in a manner that it's a proof text, if you will. The Christ has come. He's fulfilling this passage. Okay? But we've seen just these four times in 13 verses in Isaiah a pretty wide spectrum of ways that the Old Testament is used in the New Testament. I just want you to see that particular aspect of Old Testament quotation. Now, the three prophecies of Isaiah, chapter 7 through 12, 9, 1 through 7 now, was a messianic prophecy. I want to spend just a couple more minutes on that last section. So please come back to chapter 9. Again, this is material we covered last week, but you can't leave it alone. There was one more thing I really would just like to get out. So after this quotation in verses 1 and 2 about the land of Zebulun and Naphtali and Galilee, and it's, you know, so very specific, we're talking about the Christ here. Skip down to verses 6 and 7 in Isaiah 9. Isaiah 9, 6 and 7. Some of the most famous verbiage in all the Old Testament. A child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called. Now, this is the only thing I want to make reference to. You're so familiar with this. There's two totally different ways to assemble what follows. You could say his name will be called Wonderful, comma. His name would also be called Counselor. His name would be called Mighty. His name would be called God. His name would be called Eternal. His name would be called Father. And his name would be called Prince of Peace. In the original, when you're looking at the verse, you just have all those words one after the other. And only one of them becomes a phrase or has more than one word for sure for the term Prince of Peace. Well, of peace is dependent upon something. Prince it is, Prince of Peace. So people then try to, you know, struggle with this. What's his name going to be? Well, as you know, it's not a formal name anyway. And so these are descriptive terms is what it's about. When it says his name, it means, you know, descriptive terms. For my own part, brethren, what I would suggest is this, is that really there's only four designations there. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor. His name will be called Mighty God. His name will be called Eternal Father. And his name will be called Prince of Peace. But those are the two extremes. You could break these all down into seven single ideas, or you can link them together into four couplets, like I've just done, and then you'll find all kinds of people in between, and this one should be separate, and these two go together. But I'm hoping that thus far in our studies of Isaiah, after the introductory material, and hopefully just because you're reading it, Isaiah is an incredibly wonderful poet. God has used him in a manner that is really beautiful. And in Isaiah, you will come to expect that what he's going to say is not going to come across as, you know, being simple or maybe even almost sort of crude. Now, I don't mean crude, you know, in a profane sense. I just mean that the sentences are very simple. They're very, you know, unelaborate. Not with Isaiah. With Isaiah, they're just great, swelling, wonderful, you know, word pictures that get presented. And it looks to me like, if I could pretend to be a poet for a second, here you go, that using those as couplets in that manner and having the four make a balance and a rhythm that's just more, you know, raise your hand if you know the word mellifluous. Melodic. Okay? It just means it just reads more like poetry. So for me, brethren, his name will be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. But are not every one of those individual things true of Jesus? Yes. So he's not a big deal. But again, I just want to see people ruffled with it in their yard. I just think it's a gloriously beautiful thing. So here's the second prophecy. Chapter 9, verse 8 through chapter 10, verse 4. The second in what group of prophecies? Chapters 7 through 12, which are called the Emmanuel prophecies. So there's three of these Emmanuel prophecies. Finally, I'm done with the first one. And now we look at chapter 9, verse 8 through chapter 10, verse 4. And this is really easy. The Lord sends a message against Jacob and it falls on Israel. Well, okay, Israel is what it's about. All the people know it, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria. So, northern or southern tribes? Northern tribes. How many tribes in the north? 10 that went by these names, Ephraim, Samaria, and what was the third name the 10 tribes were called? Israel. After Solomon's son, whose name was Rehoboam, split the kingdom because he was harsher even than his father, foolish because he listened to the younger men instead of the older men. And so, what was the guy that said, I'm going to lead the 10 northern tribes away, we're going to do this anymore, and he built two golden calves. Yeah, that's Jeroboam the first. There'll be a Jeroboam the second. And that all took place in what year? 930 B.C. Now, brother, I throw it. I get your feedback, and I really get it. I know that if we keep repeating this, this stuff will stick for you. Take it a couple thousand times. We're only up to about 18, but we'll keep it going that way. So you're getting your time frame there. So since 930, when Rehoboam split the kingdom, and Jeroboam the first went off to take the 10 northern tribes so that they would be called Ephraim, Samaria, or Israel, and worship golden calves that were in the far north at Dan, and also in Bethel, which is real close to the southern border of those 10, we have had this northern area that had how many good kings?
Zero,
and only lasted therefore for 234 years. The Lord is sending a message to them. And in verse 10, the bricks have fallen, at that last part of verse 9, this is what people in the northern kingdom, they're the ones that are in view, they are the ones at the very end of verse 9 who are asserting in pride and in arrogance of heart the following words and ideas in verse 10. They're saying, the bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with smooth stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will replace them with cedars. So it's going to be better yet. 11. Therefore the Lord raises against them adversaries from Rezin and spurs their enemies on. The Arameans on the east and the Philistines on the west, and they devour Israel with gaping jaws. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. When, in verse 11, Rezin is sent by God against them, who's he, and what's the verse reference?
Sure.
Yes! Pick your pencil up. We are told in chapter 7, verse 1, that Rezin is the king of Aram, and I've been pointing out that Aram, as Ron just said, is what country today? Syria. Okay? So make a note at 9:11. Rezin is the king of Syria, according to 7 verse 1. And then, well, the Arameans, that's Syria. They're on the east, Philistines are on the west, and they're coming from both directions to squeeze the northern kingdom. Yet, at the end of verse 12, in spite of all this, God's anger it is, does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. 13. Yet, the people do not turn back to him who struck them three different ways in the preceding verses. They don't turn back after that, nor do they seek the Lord of hosts. So the Lord cuts off head and tail from Israel, palm branch and bulrush in a single day. The head is the elder, an honorable man. The prophet who teaches falsehood is the tail. For those who guide this people are leading them astray, and those who are guided by them are brought to confusion. Therefore, the Lord does not take pleasure in their young men, nor does he have pity on their orphans or their widows. For every one of them is godless and an evildoer. Every mouth is speaking foolishness. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. So it's going to get worse. But the last part of verse 17 is exactly the same as what that we just read a moment ago. The last part of verse 12. So a rhythm is being established. It's mellifluous. It's poetic. It's melodic when you go to verse 18. Wickedness burns like a fire. It consumes briars and thorns. It even sets the thickets of the forest aflame, and they roll upward in a column of smoke. By the fury of the Lord of hosts, the land is burned up, and the people are like fuel for the fire. No man spares his brother, and they slice off what is on the right hand, but are still hungry. And they eat what's on the left hand, but they are not satisfied. Each of them eats the flesh of his own arm. Manasseh devours Ephraim, and Ephraim Manasseh, two of the 10 northern tribes. And each of them, the rest of verse 21, and together they're against Judah. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. Who is coming against the people in verses 8 through 12 of the 10 northern kingdoms? Rezin, which is Syria, and the Philistines. Then in verses 13 and following, the Lord's going to cut off the head, and he's going to cut off the tail. It's going to be worse. He won't even have mercy on widows and orphans. Then still his anger does not turn away. Then it gets worse in verses 18 through 21. Now we're talking about civil war under the figure of cannibalism. They're fighting each other, all these tribes against each other, and still they don't turn to him. And then for the fourth time, chapter 10, verse 1 through 4. Woe to those who enact evil statutes, and to those who constantly record unjust decisions so as to deprive the needy of justice and rob the poor of my people of their rights, in order that widows may be their spoil, and that they may plunder the orphans. Now what will you do in the day of punishment and in the devastation which will come from afar? To whom will you flee for help? Where will you leave your wealth? Nothing remains but to crouch among the captives or fall among the slain. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. Now you see why I say, brethren, chapter 9, verse 8, through chapter 10, verse 4, is one set of information. It's still falling under a broader section that's dealing with Emmanuel and the remnant, which we'll see in great detail in the third of these Emmanuel prophecies in just a moment. But you can identify different sections. There's a very broad theme, there are sub-themes, and even they are broken down, but this section right here is about the reason why these people suffer. Why are they having so many troubles from all the surrounding nations, from God himself? Why has it gotten so bad? Because they're simple. Because they will not serve their Lord. And his hand will stay stretched out, his anger unabated, until what? Till they repent or die or are taken into slavery. So you learn, though, the purpose of all of this was what? To turn them back. To turn them back. Now, brethren, it is inevitable, unless the United States of America will be the first exception in all of the Earth's history, this nation will fall. You don't know when. I don't know when. As nations and empires go, they're really kind of in the middle right now. We're 200 and some odd years old. There's a lot of nations, you know, then you're less than that. But there's quite a few that have actually lasted longer. Think Roman Empire. You know, there's been some longer stuff. But inevitably, what will happen? Because it has happened every time without exception. We're going down. When it comes, God will be trying to turn the nation, the hearts of people,
That's him. That's what it'll be about. When it comes, the righteous are really going to suffer. It'll be bad for us. But it'll also, hopefully, see some fruit. If not, they don't turn like Nineveh, they don't turn like several other times that you'll see in Scripture, then the whole nation will be wiped out. It will have served its purpose. Let's just do the best we can in the circumstances that we're in. And try to be careful, brethren, you know, not to be too bitter, not to be too arrogant, not to fall prey to a lot of different kinds of sins that we can commit in the midst of seeing what God is doing with, you know, an ungodly nation. I don't know where we are on the scale. It's always, you know, easy to be depressed and think that any day now, you know, the nation's going to fall. How could it possibly get worse? But in my lifetime, I think even those of you that are older than I am, you know, you have to admit, who among us has a thought it can't get worse than this? And then what? Well, it got way worse. So, I mean, none of us know how bad it can get. Because none of us have seen it get as bad as necessary for God to do what to the nation? To destroy it. And truth be told, right now, I look out at the nation, what do you think of America? Looks pretty strong to me, as a matter of fact. It really does. And for a variety of reasons. Okay? My own son, Don, and I have an older boy, Jesse, has just come back from Costa Rica, and, you know, they knocked doors, preached sermons, I guess, or baptism, something, you know, while they were over there. How many other nations can you name that are so eager to go out and spend lots of money and time to go try and bring people to Christ in foreign countries? Now, you'd have to admit, if you know anything about history, the British used to be really big on this. Are they anymore? No. There have been times when other nations were very evangelistic and paid for it mightily. Who's the last one standing right now? It's us, brethren. You know, very often have the Chinese knocking on your door trying to convert you. You'll find it going the other way, won't you? I think that gives us a lot of hope. So don't be bitter and don't be depressed. Just serve God best you possibly can. And know that America is never mentioned in Scripture. But we can learn from these principles. We can learn from the history. So, when his anger isn't turned away, his hand is still stretched out, God's on your side trying to help people come back. But they don't. Then ultimately, he'll pull his hand back. It's only after there's nothing but smoke and ruins left behind. Okay, so let's tackle the remnant prophecies. This is the third group of the Emmanuel prophecies. I know this is, you know, maybe confusing, or maybe I just go through and say prophecy, 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 but you can see structure in what God did with Isaiah. And so, the third of these Emmanuel prophecies is chapter 10, verse 5 through chapter 12, verse 6. I'm going to try to get it all in the next 25 minutes. It'll be really tough. But they are remnant prophecies because this word remnant is going to be featured. It's prominent. It will appear six times in verses 10:5 through 12:6. It's also going to be used in the New Testament. It is a particular kind of interesting and important principle or topic. And this, the last of the third and last of the Emmanuel prophecies, will actually have two very recognizable sections. It's really about one thing, but there's two recognizable sections. And the first one's really pretty easy. The last one takes a lot of work, and it's unlikely really we'll finish it tonight, but we'll try it. In chapter 10, verse 5, where the third of the Emmanuel prophecies begins, and the first of the two sections of that third prophecy begins, chapter 10, verse 5 through verse 19 is real simple. It's just woe to Assyria. Assyria is the one that's coming to do all this damage that's being discussed in these chapters. So, woe to Assyria. And then, in chapter 10, verse 20 through 12, verse 6, there will be the focus on a remnant. But don't forget now, it's a second remnant. So, we're going to be talking about a first remnant and a second remnant. And you'll have to be heads up, reading carefully. Oh, I see. There's two of these in this prophecy here, not just one. So there'll be a first and a second remnant in chapter 10, verse 20 through 12, verse 6. So in 5 through 19, woe to Assyria. And this doesn't take a lot of comment. Let's just read it. Verse 5, woe to Assyria. Okay. The rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. I send it against a godless nation and commission it against the people of my fury to capture booty and to seize plunder and to trample them down like mud in the streets. So woe to Assyria, but what are they in the first part of verse 5? They're just an implement that God picks up, a rod of his anger. They're a staff in his hands. He's sending them. Yet in verse 7, it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather is its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. For it says, are not my princes all kings? Is not Calmo like Carchemish, or Hamath like Arpad, or Samaria like Damascus? As my hand is reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images just as I've done to Samaria and her idols? Who is speaking in verses 7 through 11? Assyria. Words in the minds and hearts of the Assyrians. Words in the minds and hearts of the Assyrian leaders. Assyria is just a stick in my hand, God says. I wield them to perform my punishment. But what do they think? They think they're big. They think they're wise. They think they're tough. They think they're smart. Verse 12. So it'll be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. Now, brother, this is a principle we're going to find in other places. You're going to find it elsewhere in Isaiah. You'll find it in Habakkuk. God uses ungodly, indefensible, horrifically unrighteous, despicable nations to do what? To punish unrighteous, despicable nations. Okay? He uses one unrighteous group to punish another unrighteous group. Could God even use a more unrighteous group, nation, to punish a lesser unrighteous nation? Yeah, well, it doesn't matter. They're both unrighteous, so you've got a scale. Some are worse than others. And so God will sometimes use a worse nation to punish a not as bad nation. And he can do vice versa whenever he likes. In this case, he's using the worst of the worst to punish his own people who are not so bad, but they're plenty bad enough. Now, verse 13. Who's the speaker whose heart is being revealed? Again, the king of Assyria. So, brethren, this is kind of like a play. It's like a little two-person conversation or something. In this particular prophecy, at the beginning, verses 5 and 6, God is the speaker. God declares what's going on. In verses 7 through 11, Assyria's king is the speaker in our little play and revealing what's going on in his heart. In verse 12, God is back as the narrator, if you will, to tell him, I'm going to punish you. I'll get you for that. And then the king of Assyria is back again in verse 13. For he has said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom I did this, for I have understanding, and I removed the boundaries of the peoples, and I plundered their treasures, and like a mighty man I brought down their inhabitants. My hand reached to the riches of the peoples like a nest, as one gathers abandoned eggs. I gathered all the earth. And there was not one that flapped its wing or opened its beak or chirped. Who's the talker?
king of Assyria. You might make a little bracket or something. You know, king of Assyria. It'd be easier to find next time. But then in verse 15, here's the Lord back. Is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? Like a club wielding those who lift it? Like a rod lifting what is not wood? Therefore, the Lord, the God of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors. And under his glory, a fire will be kindled like a burning flame. And the light of Israel will become a fire, and his Holy One a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in a single day. He will destroy the glory of his forest and of his fruitful garden, both soul and body. And it will be as when a sick man wastes away, and the rest of the trees of his forest will be so small in number that a child could write them down. What do you got? God speaking, and what's going to be left of Assyria when I'm done with them? Yeah, here's Carol getting off on her fingers. I think I did this once before. It's the funniest thing I ever saw on America's Funniest Home Video. But Dad asked the kid if he could count, you know, and he holds up his hand like Carol did. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Dad says, can you count any higher? And the kid goes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's got to be the best one ever. Give him the 100,000. At any rate, kids can't count very high, can they? So if a kid can count it, what's left?
Not much.
Not much. Not much. Now, just by the way, it's going to be a while. It's going to be probably 150 years. But 150 years later, this king of Assyria sounds like who? Well, I mean, that, you're so right, because this is about Sennacherib, but I'm looking at somebody else. 150 years later, walking about on his walls, Nebuchadnezzar. What's he wind up doing? Eating grass, right? Fingernails growing out. Okay? But when you hear these two guys, they just sound exactly the same. What do they sound like? They sound like an arrogant leader who says that he can do what nobody else can do. That what he'll do has never been done before. And he is absolutely the best there ever was, as everything you can think about. And so, when he sets about to do a task, that's all because he's so much smarter than everybody else. It's because he's so much more powerful than everybody else. What happens inevitably to every such person in biblical history? Little kids are counting what's left of them. Because what goes before a fall? Pride goes before a fall. See? So whether it's Assyria or Babylon or anybody else you want to name, once you get the big head, what's coming? Oh boy, bad stuff. Bad stuff. So, that's a pretty simple prophecy. Now we've got to take on what is giant and beautiful. A great contrast is now going to be set up in Isaiah 10:20 through 12:6. But you see, the top didn't change. And I told you last week, I'm using these ugly colors to try and stand out, you know, and be glaring and catch your attention there, that we're still in a single prophecy. It can be divided, though, into two sections. But clearly, God is playing these off of each other. So he's made a point that's real simple about Assyria. You're just a tool, is all you are. And you will be obliterated when you finish my purpose. Because you are not what you think you are. You're just an implement in my hand. Then comes 10:20 through 12:6. And now, we're going to talk about something, a remnant again. But we're also going to be talking about a glorious remnant. That wouldn't even seem, you know, it's like a contradiction in terms. Let's see how it works. So I don't have any more slides. That'll be the rest for tonight. It's a huge segment. So let's get started in verse 20 and just see how well we can do. Verse 20, chapter 10. Now, it will come about in that day. That's a really important phrase. It'll appear in both your Old and New Testaments, and you really have to be careful and think about it. I marked it in big green highlighter there. In that day, in what day? What's the day we've been talking about in the preceding section? It's the day of what country? Assyria's what? Assyria's destruction. They're going to go down. In that day, a remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. Now, brethren, can you remember? And I know it's hard just because this material is so important and it takes us several sessions to get through it. The Emmanuel prophecies started with what chapter? Chapter 7, verse 1. Now go back to 7:1 for a second. Came about the days of Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Josiah, king of Judah, Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem, waged war against it, couldn't conquer it. When it's reported to the house of David, saying the Arameans of camp and Ephraim, his heart, the hearts of his people, shook the trees before, shake with the wind. The Lord said to Isaiah, go now meet Ahaz, and say to him, in verse 4, take care, be calm, have no fear, don't be faint-hearted. But I took you to another passage in 2 Kings, and we found out last week the background historically for all of this. And what did this king who was looking up at this invasion do? He went and made a pact with what nation? Assyria and Egypt. But Assyria is the one that's most prominent in this passage. So we're going through Emmanuel prophecies. We're going through chapter after chapter, but it all started with you making contracts with ungodly nations instead of relying on your God. Now we come back to chapter 10 and verse 20. It'll come about in that day the remnant of Israel, first of those six occurrences, and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who what? Who struck them? The Assyrians. They'll never do that again. But will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. You're making, you know, these alliances with these ungodly people, they'll turn and bite you. And you'll learn your lesson. 21. A remnant will return. The remnant of Jacob to the mighty God. For though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant within them will return. It's going to be really tiny. After Assyria has been smoked, then there's a remnant going to be able to come back. Tiny little group of Jacob. But they're coming back in 21 to what? To the mighty God. Do some learn their lesson? Yes, they do. Now, brother, if you and I are still living when this country falls, be a remnant. If you can survive it, go back to work. If you can survive it, it's all part of God's plan. So, 21, the remnant will return. At the end, though, it says, a destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness, for a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord God of hosts will execute in the midst of the whole land. Heads up! Because this destruction is not that destruction which he's been talking about. Assyria is going to come in. They're going to be an instrument in the hand of God. They're going to leave the 10 northern tribes obliterated. Tiny little group is going to be able to survive that. Okay, and there'll never be a nation again. They wind up intermarrying, as we saw in the 65-year prophecy last week, to become the Samaritans. Still not very faithful, but, you know, remnant does survive. They do turn back to God, you know, and then ultimately years go by, and we're going to repeat this cycle. But then there's a complete destruction after that. That's something more. Different. Later. 24. Therefore, thus says the Lord God of hosts, O my people, who dwell in Zion. Do not fear the Assyrian who strikes you with the rod and lift up his staff against you the way Egypt did. For in a very little while my indignation against you will be spent, and my anger will be directed to their destruction. The Lord of hosts will arouse a scourge against him like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. Please write in your margin, Judges 7. That's Judges 7. I'll go back and look at it, but that's the reference, Judges 7. And his staff will be over the sea, and he'll lift it up the way he did in Egypt. So it will be in that day that his burden will be removed from your shoulders, his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be broken because of fatness, which is a good thing in their thinking. So we're not Assyria. I'll take care of him in due time. Now in 28, he's come against Iath. Now, I didn't do all of these, but I did a few so you get the gist. If you want to just make the note, Iath is about 12 or 15 miles north of Jerusalem. He's come against Iath. He's passed through Migron at Michmash, which is much closer to Jerusalem. I've been to Michmash. It's on the eastern hills of side of Mount Olivet and very close to Jerusalem itself. At Michmash, he deposited his baggage. They've gone through the pass, saying, Geba will be our lodging place. Ramah's terrified. Gibeah and Saul's fled away. Cry aloud with your voice, O daughter of Galim. Pay attention, Laish, and wretched Anathoth. Now, I warned you I wouldn't do all of them, but Anathoth is only 3 miles north. 3 miles away. Madmenah has fled. The inhabitants of Gebim have sought refuge. Yet today he'll halt at Nob. Nob is 2 miles north of Jerusalem. That's where God drew the line. Today he will halt at Nob. He shakes his fist at the mountain of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Behold, the Lord, the God of hosts, will lop off the boughs with a terrible crash. Those also who are tall in stature will be cut down. Those who are lofty will be abased. He'll cut down the thickets of the forest with an iron axe, and Lebanon will fall by the mighty one. Well, Lebanon's way up north. Assyria's going to conquer all that. Assyria's going down after they've whooped up on Israel, of whom only a small remnant will remain. Only a small remnant of the Assyrians will remain. There'll be a future, terrible and complete destruction, too. Now 11:1. Then, and this is the part that makes it so hard to get to 12:6, then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse. A branch from his roots will bear fruit, and the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. The spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and strength, a spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. In other words, you can't be tricked, you can't be deceived like most judges. And 4.5, I guess it is. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips, he'll slay the wicked. Also, righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist, and the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the kid. The calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. Also, the cow and the bear will graze. Their young will lie down together. The lion will eat straw like the ox. The nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra. And the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all of planet Earth. Hello, novel heads pop up. Because when I do that to you, you're supposed to be thinking, well, that's not what it says. No, it isn't. But that's what all the premillennialists think, isn't it? But that's not what it says. It's not what it's talking about. It's only talking about the faithful where these things will happen. They'll not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. I'm not talking about anywhere else. The earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That's true. But they don't hurt or destroy where? In all my holy mountain. Then it will come about in that day, which is now a different day, because the first word in chapter 11, verse 1, put us into the future. It went from what we've been talking about, which he said was going to come to pass pretty soon. He says then, and it's not immediately after, it's then, in a distant future, we'll get the son, the stem of Jesse, the branch, the Spirit of the Lord on him, all of which, of course, is a reference to Jesus and is quoted extensively in the New Testament to say so. Verse 10, it will come about in that day that the nations will resort to the root of Jesse. That is all Gentile nations. That is all nations, you know, including the Jews, who will stand as a signal for the peoples. Its resting place will be glorious. And then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain. But look at the remnant of his people, brethren, from Assyria, Egypt, Patros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, from the islands of the sea. He'll lift up a standard for the nations. And again, you see Jew and Gentile coming together. We'll assemble the banished ones of Israel. We'll gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And then the jealousy of Ephraim will depart. What was Ephraim doing in chapter, I can't see if I explained it. It's over in, I know I gotta find it. Okay, it's in the 9-8 prophecy. Where were they eating each other? I'm trying to find the cannibal. Where is it?
Verse
21. Yeah. The last verse in chapter 9. Thank you very much. Okay. So that's still in our minds here because this is one prophecy. And so, you know, that's not going to happen anymore. They're not going to be jealous of each other. They're not fighting each other. They're not eating each other anymore. And Judah, it says in the last part of verse 13 in chapter 11, will not harass Ephraim, which is also mentioned in the passage there at the end of chapter 9. So in 11:14, they'll swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west. Together they'll plunder the sons of the east. They'll possess Edom and Moab. The sons of Ammon will be subject to them. We're way beyond, you know, this Assyrian stuff now. The Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt. He'll wave his hand over the river in a scorching wind. He'll strike it into seven streams. Men will walk over dry shod. There'll be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of his people who will be left, just as there was for Israel in the day they came up from the land of Egypt. Then you will say on that day, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, for although you were angry with me, your anger is turned away, and you comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid, for the Lord God is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. Therefore you will joyously draw water from the springs of salvation. And in that day you will say, give thanks to the Lord, call on his name, make known his deeds among the peoples. That's all peoples. Make them remember that his name is exalted. Praise the Lord in song, for he has done excellent things. Let this be known throughout the earth. Cry aloud and shout for joy, O inhabitant of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. And you look at 13:1 and you know that's the end of this prophecy, and there's the start of another one. So, I read it all to keep it together. I've got about 1 minute left. Let me just say, we've got yet other places where we'll have to deal with this. Brethren, in 11:1, particularly, down through 12:6, is a messianic prophecy. It's an Emmanuel prophecy. It's a God with us prophecy. It's in that day when Jesus establishes his kingdom. We, from 7:1 to 12:6, have passed through a lot of world history. But it's about not fearing the physical, looking for the spiritual, being just a tiny remnant if you have to suffer the destruction of your nation, because one day salvation will come. But that salvation in that day is because of a king and a government that rests on his shoulders, a wonderful counselor, a mighty God, an eternal father, a prince of peace. And when he reigns, you don't fear anything. Because he is your salvation. What kind of salvation? Spiritual salvation. That's a messianic prophecy. That's an Emmanuel prophecy.
That is a second remnant prophecy after the utter destruction that will follow a terrible destruction at the hands of the Assyrians. But it's not the utter destruction. What do you suppose the utter destruction is? That the second remnant will survive. 70 A.D. It's a messianic prophecy about after you no longer fear physical stuff at all. We become spiritual kingdom. Okay? Let me just do one thing. The wolf and the lamb and all of that. Brethren, those are figures of speech. They're dealing with people's characters and not actual animals. This is not, you know, the physicality of the actual beast in the mythology, the premillennialists. It's ridiculous, and you'll know that. I'll suggest, if you go read Romans 15, first 13 verses, they quote from 11 verse 10 here in Romans 15, 12. The way it is used by the inspired writer is not to produce the simplistic and silliness of the mythology of premillennialism, where physical animals are going to lose all these, you know, qualities. It's the figure of how people in all nations in the Holy Mountain will get along. Okay, so Lenny, there you are. Good luck with that. What I suggest, if you really want to go back over 11, be my guest, because you can see I didn't spend a lot of time on it, but there it is. Okay, comment or question?